Looking at this duel between Jehovah God and Baal. Elijah instituted this by challenging the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah. And Ahab gathered everybody, and it says the whole nation of Israel is gathered there at Mount Carmel. And wanted to show you on the map here this evening. The traditional site is up here on this little promontory. Mount Carmel. It's certainly a possibility that this is where things took place, but it's also a possibility that right down here by Jezreel is another location, because you have the mountainous range there. The fact that altars were built on top of these mountains, they did tend to build altars of worship on top of the highest mountain in a small range, right? So that, because of course, if you want to worship your God, you have to be closer to where He's at. That's why we build the Tower of Babel. That's why, you know, they build on top of hills. That's why, that's just why they build up on those high places there. So it's possible that it's in either one of those places. We're not given a whole lot of specific information there, but They all gather together, and in verses 20 and following, Elijah sets the stage by issuing the challenge and giving the rules for the fight, sort of like at the beginning of a boxing match, and they all, you know, the ref comes out and says, you know, none of this, you know, no punching, no hitting, you know, whatever. In a boxing match, no punching, no hitting. No biting, no kicking. Yeah, and they set the rules for it, and everybody agrees, and then the fight begins. Well, Elijah's giving the rules for this, and he says in verse 23, "Let two bulls be given to us, and let them choose which one, choose one bull for themselves. Cut it in pieces, lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. I'll prepare the other bull, lay it on the wood, and put no fire to it. You call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord, and the God who answers by fire, He is God." So those are the rules for this contest. You get to pick the best bull. Elijah doesn't even reserve to himself the prerogative of picking the best animal. So he says, you can pick first. You take whichever bull you want. And they say, all right, it's a good idea. At the end of verse 24, it is well spoken. So everybody accepts the terms of this challenge. If Baal is the god of the storm, then he ought to be able to bring some lightning to start a fire on the altar and consume the sacrifice, right? But if Jehovah is God, and Baal is actually nothing but an idol, then things will go rather differently. And so that's the challenge. And we got into the middle of it, there up through the end of verse 29. The Baal worshipers are doing their thing. They're calling on Baal. They're getting desperate about it too, because it says, you know, they cried aloud. They cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation. But there was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. It's a very emphatic thing that the historian writes for us there at the end of verse 29. That threefold statement, no voice, no answer, no attention. And the emphasis there is that there's absolutely no response. They've been doing this all day. They started early in the morning, jumping and hooping around, and nothing happened. Along about noontime was when Elijah began the taunting. And we looked at this a little bit last week with his taunts to the prophets. Cry aloud, he's a god. Either he's musing, or he's relieving himself, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's asleep and must be awakened. We said, we who have a biblical understanding of what God is like look at that and say, well, that's just craziness. Why is he being so sarcastic? Well, in a way, he's not being that sarcastic. He was somewhat serious, because that's how people conceived of their gods. The prophet, is it Ezekiel, talks about making an idol. Maybe it's Isaiah. I'm doing this off the top of my head, and I forget exactly where it's at. Either Isaiah or Ezekiel, they both talk about the foolishness of idolatry. And one of them actually gives a very accurate description of how they would make an idol. So they would carve the idol, they would overlay it with gold, and then they would have this elaborate ceremony to call the god down to dwell in the idol, to make it a node where the god could come and dwell on earth and have his needs ministered to. They had to perform this ceremony. And so during the ceremony, they would, of course, eat a meal. Well, you just carved this idol out of a chunk of wood and covered it with gold. What do you do with the rest of the tree? You cook your meal on it. And so the prophets point out the craziness of that and say, you're going to bow down and worship that block of wood, but that block of wood you cooked your dinner with. It's from the same tree. Doesn't that seem a little ridiculous to you? And, of course, the people worshiping Baal said, oh, no. Makes perfect sense. But the prophets and God crawls out and says, I made the whole tree. You're going to worship that part of the tree, but that part of the tree you're going to burn and cook your food on. This is craziness. It's silliness. It's ignorance. It doesn't make any sense at all. Why would you do this? But that's what happens when you abandon biblical truth. God becomes whatever you conceive him to be. He becomes a god of your own making. He becomes whatever makes sense to you. Why do you think pluralism is the call of the day? Because our world wants a god that makes sense to themselves. And every person can have their own god, by the way. So whatever you think God should be like, that's great for you. You worship that god. Whatever you think God should be like, that's great for you. How often are your two gods going to line up? Not very often. Right? And so you have all these different gods, and everybody just goes on their own opinion and what they feel like he should be like. How often, if you get into a conversation with somebody that it's not a regular churchgoer or student of the scriptures, and you ask them a question about spiritual things, what do they normally answer? The first three words, I can guarantee, almost always. Well, I think. Well, I think it's like this. Well, I think it's like this. So let me ask you a question. We'll pick on Daniel here for a moment. And we're going to go between the Dans. This is our battle of Dans, right? So, Daniel, what do you think? Do you think Mr. Dan is a mean-hearted person? No? You think he's a nice guy? Yeah. But if you had said, yeah, I think he's a mean-hearted person, would that make him, Dan? Would that make you a mean-hearted person? He might start. Yeah. That's a great answer. At least towards one other person, right? Because we know that what I think about another person doesn't change the objective truth of who they are. I can think that Dan has pink hair. It doesn't make it true. His hair's not pink, right? I can think he's a mean-hearted person, but he's not. And you all can look at me and say, who are you talking about? You're not talking about the same Dan, are you? And we'd say, no. And it is the same thing with God. He is what he is. The very name that we use for him, Jehovah, derives from that statement that he made to Moses on Mount Sinai when Moses said, who should I tell them is sending me? And what was his answer? I am that I am. Why does God say that of himself? Because how do you define him other than saying he is the one who is? He is, what is the term that they use? He is the uncaused cause of all other things. He's the first mover, but the unmoved. He's the one that begins everything, or scriptural language is the beginning and the end. He's the one, like Kathy said, who sees the end from the beginning. How can he do that? Because he's the one in control of it all. So whether somebody thinks God is a certain way has no real bearing on whether he actually is that way, right? So how do you know what God is like? If everybody can just come up with what they think God should be like and what makes sense to them, how do you know which one is true? Well, that question doesn't even make sense in a pluralistic society because they don't care which one is real. Because to them, it doesn't matter. God is whatever you make him to be. So if you start talking about what is God actually like in his reality, in his own intrinsic being, you're asking a question that is completely outside of their thinking on it. And that's sort of the way that it was here as well. And there's nothing new under the sun. The way people conceived of gods in 10th century BC Israel is very much the same the way people conceive of God or gods today. apart from biblical truth. And the only thing that keeps us moored on what's real is God's self-revelation to us. How do we know anything about God? Because He told us so. He revealed Himself, whether through creation and general revelation or whether through special revelation of the Scripture. God revealed Himself. It'd be like the only way Daniel could know anything about Dan is if Dan comes up and says, "Hello, I'm Dan. Nice to meet you. I'm a nice guy. My hair's not hot pink." Okay. And he begins telling Daniel. And of course, by spending time here over the last few years, Daniel's gotten to know Dan. So now he does know what Dan is like. We know God only because He revealed Himself to us. Other than that, we would come up with some of the crazy things that they came up with. So the gods of the ancient world and the gods of today even are very much like people, with all the same faults, failures, weaknesses. They're just stronger. They're bigger. They have a few more powers. So Baal is a typical guy, whatever that means, right? He's a typical guy, but he can control the storms. Other than that, he's just like anybody else. Except with all the pride and arrogance that goes along with having that kind of power, right? So why would it... You know, he's not being all that sarcastic when he says he's a god. He's musing or he's relieving himself or he's on a journey. And well, they figure that must, oh, you know what? You must be right. He must be busy doing something else. So let's get his attention. And that's when they begin crying louder and cutting themselves with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation. But there was no voice, no answer, no attention. And this is when, verse 30, Elijah is going to step up. Elijah said to all the people, "Come near to me." And all the people came near to him. You know, one little detail I think I forgot to mention. Who did Elijah invite to this duel?
All of Israel.
All of Israel. And? The 450 prophets of Baal. And? 400 prophets of Asherah, right? Look at verse 22. Who shows up? No, the 400 prophets of Asherah don't. If you look at verse 22, he says Baal's prophets are 450 men. So obviously they have a better chance of success in this, but who's not mentioned there? Asherah's prophets are not there. You wonder why that might be. Who was in charge of the prophets of Asherah? Jezebel. I think maybe Jezebel was on to Elijah and she realized this was doomed to failure for her people. She didn't let him come and say, "No, you can't come out and play with Elijah. You're going to stay here at Jezreel." Well, at any rate, they're not there. So all the people come near. We're back in verse 30. Elijah said to all the people, "Come near to me." And the people came near to him. And he repaired the altar of the Lord that had been thrown down. So there's already an altar to Jehovah up on this mountain. Why do you think it might have been torn down? Yeah, probably when Ahab and Jezebel came to power and they were actively seeking to push the worship of Jehovah out of Israel, that's probably when this altar fell into disrepair. Okay. So he repairs it. He took 12 stones according to the number of the 12 tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord came, saying, "Israel shall be your name." And with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord. Now, what's the significance of these stones? Why does the historian note for us this specific detail? Why would it be important that Elijah builds this altar out of 12 stones, one for each of the tribes of Israel? Okay, so all of Israel should be represented by this contest, right? All right, this decision should stand firm for the entire nation, not just for a few tribes. All right? Why is it important, do you think, that he references "Israel shall be your name"? What does Israel mean? From the two Hebrew words, Israel. El means God. Isra means a prince. You are a prince of God. Who do you belong to as a nation? You belong to God. Why are you worshiping Baal? the whole nation. What are you doing? Go back to your foundations. Look at these 12 stones and remember how this nation came into being. What were they before God made them a nation? A bunch of slaves. They were nobody. They had no standing in society. They had no legal standing. They certainly had no national standing. And yet God saved them out of Egypt with all of His signs and wonders, brought them across the Red Sea, brought them across the Jordan River, established them in the land of Canaan, drove out all the Canaanites with all of their gods. This is a reminder. Israel, what are you doing worshiping Baal? That's who God drove out before you so that you could live here, Prince of God. So he rebuilds the altar. Verse 32, and the stones, with the stones, he built an altar in the name of the Lord. And he made a trench about the altar as great as would contain 2 seahs of seed. So we're talking about, 15 quarts of seed that you could pour into this thing. And the word there is not like a trench that can just contain it. It's how much space it would take to sow that much seed is the wording that's used there. It's a trench in which you could sow about 15 quarts of seed. So what's our standard planting rate in decent soil? How many bushels an acre?
Soybeans, about
2. 2 bushels an acre? Okay. So how about wheat? Okay. So, bushel basket, about yay big. I don't know how much that equates to in quarts. 15 quarts seems like a lot less than a bushel. But, 15 quarts would be what? About 4 or 5 gallons, 4.5 gallons. A bushel 60 pounds. Okay, so you got about half a bushel. So we could sow about a half an acre with that amount of seed. Now they didn't plant them the way we do, as quite as strategically. They just would broadcast them. But you're talking about a very sizable ditch here. All right? And so that's the important point here. It's a pretty big ditch. He digs around the altar, and he put the wood in order and cut the bull in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, fill 4 jars with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. Elijah loves a challenge, doesn't he? I mean, he's really just stacking the deck against God. They got to pick the better bull. Even when in the law of God, it says you offer the best one to the Lord, right? But I mean, they're already operating somewhat outside the law here because they weren't supposed to be worshiping Baal. And so this challenge is meant to get them back into the law. But he says, I'm going to let you pick the bull. You have more people than I do, so that should catch your God's attention. And I'm going to drench my sacrifice in water just to make it interesting for God. How's he going to set this whole thing on fire when it's soaking wet? And so he does. He fill 4 jars with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. Verse 34, he said, do it a second time. They did it a second time. And he said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. And the water ran around the altar and filled the trench also with water. So not only is the sacrifice sopping wet, the wood is now soaking wet. And the ground is soaking wet. Ever tried to start a fire with wet wood out in wet ground? Anybody ever accomplished it? Dan, did you with the Boy Scouts, you ever do it with 2 sticks?
No.
No?
Flint and steel?
Okay. I tried it once with the 2-stick things and made a bow out of it with my shoe. I went through a shoelace doing that. Yeah. It's hard. I got it warm. I got the wood warm, but I couldn't get anything to catch fire, so. Yeah, that's right. Yep. What's that? Is it Les Stroud? Yeah, so he's always grabbing little bits of this moss off of trees. Oh, this is perfect stuff, and puts it down and right. Like he's got a match in there somewhere, the cheater. Or he's got one of those magnesium sticks. See these things? It's It's a stick of magnesium, and when you drag your knife across it, it just throws sparks everywhere. And so you're supposed to get a little thing of kindling and whoosh. I couldn't get that to work either, though. So it's a good thing our family doesn't have to depend on me, the hunter-gatherer. So everything's wet, completely drenched. Verse 36, about the time of the offering of the oblation. So we're right around 3 o'clock in the afternoon here. Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back. There's a simple little prayer, isn't it? Aren't you glad our God doesn't demand flowery prayers before he'll answer? Because how many of us would have our prayers just go nowhere? Half the time, when there's something that I really need to pray about, I can't even think about what to say. You just sort of sit there like, but God, and you just pour out your heart in wordless supplications to him. Well, Elijah doesn't make the prayer complicated. I mean, just the elements that are in there even are really simple. Lord, just make yourself known to Israel. Now, going back again, how did Israel become a nation? God made him a nation. How did he do that? Brings him out of Egypt and then does what? Parts the waters of the Red Sea. All the plagues on Egypt. I mean, and then they went to Sinai and lived there for about a year or so. And what did they eat while they were there? Manna falling out of the sky and quail blown in on the winds. Where'd they get their water? God made it gush out of a rock. What else does God have to do to prove that he's God? Yeah. But here, we're kind of dumb, hard-headed sort of people, aren't we? We need constant reaffirmations, don't we? Let your people know today that you are Lord, that you are God, and that you have turned their hearts back. Lord, you're calling your people back to faithfulness. Verse 38, then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. Isn't that great picturesque language? The fire just licked up the water like it was thirsty. Ever seen thirsty fire? All right. Fire and water usually don't go together very well, but here this fire, God uses it and just consumes everything. Not only does it burn up the offering, it burns up the wood, it burns up the stones, and it burns up the dust. Everything is completely consumed as God pours out his power in a very visible way here. Verse 39, when the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, Ah, the Lord, he is God! The Lord, he is God! I mean, what other answer really could you give at this point? God, he's God. And they're using both terms of him here, because if it had gone the other way, you can be sure that they would have said, Baal, he is God. But here they are saying, Jehovah, he is God. And they reiterate it in their stupor because of this crazy display of God's power that's going on here. And while they're all riled up, verse 40, Elijah says to them, Seize the prophets of Baal and let not one of them escape. And they seized them. And Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slaughtered them there. 450 people killed down there at the brook Kishon. So, God tells us not to murder, right? When is murder not murder? Or so maybe we should ask it this way. When is killing not killing? Sorry. When is killing not murder? I'll get the wording right. In battle is one. In self-defense? When God commands it? Government. Is government always allowed to kill? Not always. So there are limitations. Okay. Yeah, the strictest definition you can give is that killing is not murder when you have the authority to take life. Right? There are times when government has the authority to take life. God's very clear on that. There are times, as Hannah said, when the individual citizen has the right to take life. If my life is in danger, I have a right to defend myself. That's a biblical concept. The government does have the right to take life in certain instances, but in other instances, it does not have right to take life. In war, there is a right for killing, and so it's not murder. Now, even in war, we set aside some things to say, now that person didn't need to die, you murdered him. And there are differences, right? But the long and short of it is, does God ever not have the right to take a life? God created life. It all belongs to Him. God can never murder. And so anytime God says, take that life, He's doing so justly. Boy, our world hates to hear that one too. Like, God could just kill anybody. He can just tell you. You can just walk around and say, God told me to kill somebody and do it and think you're okay. No. No. But that is the theological answer. Yes, God does have the right to take life because He created it all. It all belongs to Him. So, all right. Is Elijah part of the government? Under what authority is Elijah taking the lives of these 450 men? Is this a lynching? Gary says, no, it's not a lynching. It's the authority of, well, where did God give him that authority? He's a prophet, okay? He works for the Lord. Yeah, in the law, God commanded this to be done, right? Anybody worshipped an idol, they were supposed to be committed to death. They've forfeited the right to live under the law. So, should we just run around killing people that don't worship Christ? Why not? Doesn't God say that in the law? Oh, we're not under the law, are we? Okay. Is there a distinction between Israel under the law and an American? Yeah, you better believe there is. We are not a country governed by the Mosaic law, are we? We are governed by our law that we established at the founding of this country, which doesn't allow for just running around and killing people that worship other gods. Will there come a point in history where people that worship other gods will be subject to the death penalty? Yes, there will, on Christ's kingdom, right? So what Elijah's doing here is enforcing the law that was in effect in his country. He's not committing any breach of legality here in doing this. God's law was in effect. Who appointed the kings of the northern Israel? God did. He set those kings in place, and they were there to enforce His covenant law upon Israel. They weren't doing it. And so Elijah calls them back to it. So this executing of the 450 prophets is not a lynching. It is an execution of valid law upon these people that had broken the law of their country, right? And so there they are, 450 of them, slaughtered them there. This is a neat example of a non-official enforcing the law where the government refused to do so. Because Ahab wasn't going to do this, was he? Imagine him having to go home and face Jezebel if he was the one that executed these guys. Probably would have been a rough night in paradise. Of course, I'm sure he had plenty of couches he could have slept comfortably on. Well, verse 41, the contest is over. It's been decisively decided. How's that for redundant? But verse 41, there's another thing going on in the country that hasn't been settled yet. What is that? Jezebel's still queen. That hasn't been changed at all. But what circumstance has the country been under for the last few years? Drought. There's still no rain. All right, there's still apparently some water because Elijah's able to get enough buckets of water to soak his sacrifice out of the brook Kishon. That's true, wasting all that water, right? Yeah. And Elijah said to Ahab, verse 41, go up, eat and drink, for there is a sound of a rushing of rain. Why is he telling him to go eat and drink? Celebrate what? Yeah, this is going to be a step of faith for Ahab. You want me to go up and have a feast right after we just killed all these guys? We know as a nation we've been worshiping Baal and we shouldn't have been. And so you want me to go up and feast after that? But you also want me to go up and feast when there's a drought on? But Elijah is telling him, hey, the drought's over. It's just a short matter of time here before it's going to stop. Ahab went up to eat and drink. I don't think you had to push Ahab to celebrate and feast too hard, right? You didn't have to twist his arm very far. And Elijah went up to the top of Mount Carmel, and he bowed himself down on the earth, put his face between his knees, and he said to his servant, go up now, look toward the sea. And he went up and looked and said, there's nothing. And he said, go again, seven times. And at the seventh time, he said, behold, a little cloud like a man's hand is rising from the sea. Now, let me draw out from this one. When Elijah called for fire from heaven, how long was his prayer? Kind of short, simple. And how quickly did God answer? It was immediate. Now, Elijah's praying for rain. How long does he have to pray? Seven times. And then he starts to see a little inkling of an answer. We can't bind God one way or t'other with our prayer, right? He commands us to pray. He delights to answer. He delights to intervene on behalf of his people. But how he answers and when he answers are his prerogative. And we've got to trust him with that. Sometimes you're going to pray and God's going to answer quickly. Sometimes you're going to pray and pray and pray and pray and pray. And you're going to keep looking for the answer and say, nope, I still don't see any clouds on the horizon. And then you're going to pray and pray and pray and pray and pray again. And you're going to look and say, well, I don't know. That looks like maybe a rain cloud out there. Right. Persevere in prayer until you see God's answer clearly one way or the other. Well, Elijah does. A little cloud like a man's hand rising from the sea. And he said, go up, say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down, lest the rain stop you. Well, here's the issue. Okay, you can't drive chariots in muddy ground. The wheels get stuck. And so, Ahab, if you're going to make it back to one of your cities, and he's going to be heading towards Jezreel here, then you've got to get off this mountain now before the heavy rain starts, because it's going to be heavy. And we're getting a great little display of this right now. What happens with a heavy rain when there hasn't been a rain for a long time and the ground is hard? It doesn't soak in, right? It all just rushes off. Because the ground's so hard, it can't take the water. I mean, it's kind of the same thing we've got going right now. All that snow is melting, but the ground is frozen 2 inches down. So where's the water go? Just sits there, makes your boots muddy. The entryway to your house is all covered in dirt. Right? Try to walk out to feed your chickens, and you're sinking 3 inches into the mud. It's just muddy. So Ahab, you better get back to the city here. This is going to be rough. We're going to get a lot of rain. So in a little while, the heavens grew black with clouds and wind, and there was a great rain, and Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. And so here's just one of the issues that makes me think that Ahab was not that far from Jezreel, is that by this point, all right, the whole contest took most of the day with the prophets. And then there was the slaughtering of the prophets, and right about the time of the evening oblation. So we're in mid to late afternoon there already, and then Ahab eats a meal, and now he's got to have time to get back to Jezreel before the rain starts, and I would say presumably before dark sets in too far. So I don't think he had to go very far. That's part of what makes me think that he was closer to Jezreel than way up here at the traditional site. Because from the traditional site to Jezreel is 28 miles. And that'd be kind of hard to traverse in a quick period of time. I know a chariot will go a little faster, so he might have made that in half a day on a chariot. But he didn't have even half a day. It's already getting on to afternoon. So I think he was probably somewhere closer here to Jezreel. But Ahab rode and went to Jezreel, and the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he gathered up his garment and ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. So Elijah outruns a chariot and gets to Jezreel first, because there's more to be done, isn't there? He's made a decisive victory in the battle for the hearts of the people of Israel, but now it's got to be followed through. There has to be real lasting change. How often does a nation encounter a disaster and their outward appearance is repentance and turning back to God in faith, but inwardly it really doesn't happen? What happened at 9/11? I mean, a lot of people came back to church for 2 or 3 weeks because everybody started talking about, oh, we need to get back to faith in God, don't we? And did it last? Revivals rarely last long. Well, we'll see what happens here. See how Elijah's revival goes in chapter 19. Any questions about what's going on here so far? We'll finish up there. It's a little bit early, but that's okay.